American. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace.
This is American Life, Myra Glass. Today's program, scrambling to get off the ice. We have stories of people in difficult situations who are trying to move. You know, they're trying to fix things. And for a while, anyway, they are running in place, just attempting one tactic after another, hoping something is going to work. We've arrived at Act Two of our program, Act Two, Going Under. So this next story is about somebody who had a lot of options for fixing the problem that she faced. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say she tried them all. Her name is Jessica Hopper. She's a music journalist who used to help us here with the music on our show. And the story is about her and a doctor and sexual misconduct. In other words, content that might not be right for everybody. And before we start, I will point out that the doctor in the story denies any wrongdoing and has steadfastly denied it from the start. In fact, when this got before a judge, the judge ruled that there was not enough proof to meet the standard necessary to establish misconduct on the doctor's part. Though he said he found Jessica's testimony to be, quote, emotional and believable. He found her credible. Here's Jessica.
On March 1st, 2012, I was in the hospital delivering my son, and an anesthesiologist repeatedly groped me while administering my epidural. I've told the story of what he did to me again and again, dozens of times over the last 7 years, to the hospital, the police, the detectives, my attorney, the state medical licensing investigator, my victim advocate, a judge, a reporter, another detective, and eventually people close to me. The story has only become more precise in order to preempt the questions I know will come. I can speak it all in an unbroken monologue. I start with how this was my second son, why we chose this neighborhood hospital. I offer my state of mind as my husband drove me there, how alert and aware I was. I recount how the anesthesiologist asked my husband and my doula to leave the room, how he had me take my gown down over my pregnant belly, how his process was methodical, but entirely different than the epidural I got with my first son. I trace on my body how the doctor ran an injection line, a thin plastic tube, from a spot on my back, and inexplicably taped it right between my breasts. I pinpoint that moment as when I know something was off, how I read his name tag and took note of his name, where he stood, where the light was in the room, approximately what time of day. I detail how he put his hands on my breasts, cupped and held them. I describe the touch as sexual and not clinical. I describe how he was silent when I asked, "What are you doing?" and how he did it again. It did not stop until I said, "What the f*** are you doing?" I explain how he did not look at me and just left the room. How I told my husband immediately after he came back in the room. About an hour and a half later, within a minute or two of delivering my son, I told the entire room what the doctor had done to me. But how I told them came out sarcastic and nervous, almost like a joke, saying that I was so happy to have an epidural that I almost didn't mind that the doctor had felt me up. I knew they heard me because the neonatal nurses weighing my son froze and one locked eyes with me. My midwife told me, "Don't say that. That didn't happen. Don't say that." This is the part in the story where my monologue changes. It becomes a litany of who I told and how. Have I set a reminder alarm on my phone, and at least once a week during my children's nap time, I would call the hospital to try to tell someone what happened, to try to navigate to the right voicemail, the hospital administrators, HR, the receptionist, the patient advocate. How I called for weeks until someone took down my account. I soon got a letter from the hospital telling me that they'd looked into it and that my account was unsubstantiated. I filed a complaint online with the state medical licensing board. I just wanted to stop this from happening to anyone else. I filed a police report. A few weeks later, I did several long interviews with a nice detective. His concern and care felt meaningful after months of being told that no one believed me. A few weeks later, a new detective was assigned to my case, and I started over, retelling the story several times over the course of a year. The new detective would periodically update me with progress in my case. They were dramatic stories, made him and the other cops sound like cowboys. He told me they had gone to the hospital to interview the doctor, and they'd been blocked by hospital staff. He told me when they went back with a warrant, the doctor had fled the country. He told me that they put out an international APB on him and had tracked him. He told me that they had gone to the doctor's suburban mansion and arrested him at dawn on Christmas morning, and now the doctor was scared. I had started to doubt what the detective was telling me. A few months later, the detective had me meet him in person at the shopping center by the county courthouse. He sat me down at a glass table across from a Sephora and told me that the state's attorney was declining to take the case or even bring charges because he said, she said cases were impossible to prosecute. He urged me to give up on the case and go on with my life. He said that the doctor was probably scared enough that he had stopped. Sitting there in the mall with the detective, after 18 months of wild stories and no charges, I had the sinking feeling that this was a performance of some sort, telling me that justice had been exhausted and hoping I would believe it, so he could close up my case file and call it a day. I realized I needed to switch tactics. I left the meeting and called a lawyer friend who referred me to an attorney who was willing to help me bring a civil case, pro bono. After a few months, this lawyer laid out some options for me, but then he followed that with exactly what the detective had said. It was my word against the doctor, and with cases like this, good outcomes were rare, that he had seen victims come out the other side destroyed. I knew that was true, and I trusted what he was telling me. I felt like unless I had video of this happening, I wouldn't be believed. But I wanted the doctor to face consequences. What the doctor had done had filled me with fear and anxiety. I was anxious about being touched. As a result, I hadn't seen a doctor or a dentist in years since delivering my son. What this doctor did in this setting that's supposed to be safe, where I was at my most vulnerable, in labor. After that, how could I trust anyone? I didn't feel safe. I had nightmares, and I felt shame. Not for what the doctor had done, but that maybe I could have done something differently, so others would have taken this more seriously. My attorney said he would pursue the case if I wanted, but he suggested I move on and focus on the good things in my life, my family, my career. He assured me that if anyone else ever came forward, that my civil complaint would be there to bolster their account. On Valentine's Day 2015, feeling deeply discouraged, I told my lawyer to drop my case. I didn't talk about it or tell friends or family because I just wanted this all to go away. I tried to forget, but I couldn't. In December 2017, I was at home and folding laundry when I got a call from an investigator with the state licensing board. She said she was new to the position and was just following up on her predecessor's open cases and would I be willing to talk to her. It'd been 5 years. I was ambivalent and cynical. She asked me to sign a release so she could get my medical records. I didn't bother. I felt like there's no use in going through this again, and it was painful to pretend otherwise. She called again a few weeks later and asked me if I would tell her my story. Over the course of an hour, I did. But I was certain there was no use telling the story again. I no longer believed anyone could help me or stop him. In February 2018, the investigator called me and told me that there was a development in my case. Another victim had come forward with an almost identical claim. A prosecutor she worked with said if I signed consent forms to release my medical records, they could file an emergency suspension of the doctor's license that would stop him from practicing. I said yes. He asked me if I would be willing to testify against the doctor. I said yes. Finally, I was being believed because there were two of us. I got off the phone and involuntarily screamed over and over before collapsing on the floor, sobbing. I was furious there were now two of us. I was elated there were now two of us. We were not in this alone. What I'd learned about the woman who'd come forward was that she was undocumented, a single mom. She did not speak much English, and she was testifying. I felt overcome with love and gratitude for her, this brave woman I didn't know, this woman who was taking a risk coming forward. The state medical licensing board was moving for the suspension of the doctor's license. I met with two prosecutors to prepare to testify. They only had a few days. During this, I found out that the detectives initially assigned to my case, including the detective who had told me he'd arrested the doctor, the detective who had met me at the mall, he had never made any notes during the nearly 2 years he'd been on my case. Not once in all the times he had interviewed me. He never interviewed or arrested the doctor. He never brought my case to the state's attorney. He just sat on it. I found out that my initial complaint to the licensing board had been dismissed without investigation because I had misspelled the doctor's last name. The first time the state regulators became aware of my case was in the summer of 2015, after I had dropped it. Everything I had done all the so-called right steps to pursue had amounted to nothing. The cogs had never caught. The licensing board prosecutors apologized profusely, continually. They said they could have tried to prosecute the doctor years ago. The hearing happened last June. The doctor testified he was not guilty and brought a naked mannequin to the hearing room for purposes of demonstration. The midwife testified too, admitted to saying in the delivery room, "Don't say that," though she denied ever saying to me, "That didn't happen." The other woman, the one who came forward, she testified all morning, and I testified after her. We did not meet. I had to ID the doctor who victimized me. He was sitting behind me. I couldn't miss him. The doctor's defense attorneys tried to suggest this was all a ploy cooked up by my husband, that I had claimed being assaulted in order to try to get a settlement from the hospital. The doctor's defense attorney asked me why, if this was so devastating. Why hadn't I told people? Why hadn't I gotten help? I tried to explain that I just wanted this to go away. What I didn't understand well enough to explain at the time was that I didn't want to deal with anyone's reactions. I didn't want to wonder if another person believed me. I didn't want anyone to feel sorry for me. They asked me about timelines. They tried to trip me up. It didn't work. The prosecutors told me I had done well. I left the hearing exhausted. But I felt so light, I felt like I was going to float away. I felt like there was nothing I couldn't do. I felt like Wonder Woman, like when she lifts a car with a single hand. I thought about the other woman. I wondered how she felt. I wondered if she felt the same.
Jessica Hopper. The doctor in her story, his medical license was suspended with an indefinite suspension for a minimum of 3 years, and he was fined $15,000 for what he did to the other woman. He was not disciplined for anything relating to Jessica because there wasn't enough proof for her claims. We approached him for comment, and his lawyer sent us a one-sentence statement denying any wrongdoing and pointing out that the doctor is in the process of appealing his suspension. We also reached out to the detective, who Jessica says met with her at the mall, and the head of investigations above him. Neither responded. Our program was produced today by Robin Semyon. The people who put our show together today includes Elna Baker, Zoe Chase, Aviva de Kornfeld, Neil Drumming, Hillary Elkins, Jared Floyd, Damian Graves, Seth Lind, Stone Nelson, Catherine Raimondo, Ben Phelan, Nadia Raymond, Christopher Sotala, Matt Tierney, Nancy Updike, Julie Whittaker, and Diane Wu. Our managing editor is David Kestenbaum. Special thanks today to Jessica Andrews, John Bice at American Oversight, Kate Brannon, Barry Hardiman, Steve Lichtig, Kelly Fasene, Ben Terrace, Andy Wright, and Mark Rozelle. Our website, thisamericanlife.org, where you can listen to our archive of over 600 episodes for absolutely free, or download our shows using the This American Life app. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia. You know, he and his friends have always had suspicions about how I got to host this show.
We all suspect he was put there for one reason only, to interfere with the Mueller investigation.
I will neither confirm nor deny. I'm Ira Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.